I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
I want to welcome everyone to this episode of The American Idea. You know, sometimes on The American Idea, we love to talk history and dive deep into American history. Sometimes we like to get into the fundamental principles of this country as they're embodied in certain institutions like the Supreme Court. And sometimes we like to have contemporary conversations about what's happening right now in American public life. And boy, is there anything more important in the last week happening right now in American public life than the elections of 2024? And that's what we're going to be talking about today. And I'm delighted to be joined on this episode by Professor Vincent Cannato. Vince is associate professor at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He is a great student of American politics. It's his vocation, and I think avocation, to study American politics, to understand American politics, not just, of course, contemporarily, but also in historical context. And in that context, he himself is a wonderful author. He has written a book called American Passage, The History of Ellis Island. And he just told me that he's working on a biography of a 20th century U.S. cardinal on the issue of Catholics and the Cold War. That's going to be an interesting book. He's a terrific writer. If you've read his works, if you haven't, let me encourage you to go take a look at Professor Cannato's work, especially American Passage, The History of Ellis Island, and his new book. Vin, welcome to The American Idea.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
The elections of 2024. Wow. Around the world, people are saying it's a kind of seismic earthquake. Members of the media, a lot of them profess to be totally shocked. Were you shocked?
I wasn't terribly shocked. No, I think the polls did a reasonably decent job of showing a pretty close race with Trump probably edging out Harris. Also, if you look at the fundamentals of the country now, the right track, wrong track numbers were hugely wrong track for a long time. All the other sort of indicators showed that the incumbent party was going to be in big trouble. And I think that's the best way to look at this. This was a vote against the incumbent party, and Harris was the incumbent vice president. As much as she was, it was an awkward position for her, but it was a vote against Biden. It was a vote against Harris. It was a vote against the way things have been over the last few years, whether it's the inflation, whether it's the border, whether it's the botched Afghanistan withdrawal. I mean, all of the things that have gone on the last 4 years, as well as, you know, Biden's own condition, and which kind of came to a head with that disastrous debate. I think it made sense with all of Trump's own weaknesses that it was going to be a hard year for the incumbent party.
I think some people, our listeners, are wondering, you know, how much of it is Trump's strength versus Biden-Harris's weakness. Where do you fall on that?
Yeah, I think Biden-Harris, there are lots and lots of weaknesses. I think she was a pretty weak candidate. I don't think she ran a great campaign, although some people have tried to say that she ran a great campaign. I think she made a poor choice for vice president in Waltz. I mean, I think I'm not sure Shapiro would have helped her win, but I think it would have been a stronger pick. So I think there was a lot of weaknesses there, but Trump has a lot of weaknesses, but he also has some strengths, and he was able to play, I mean, the Joe Rogan interview, for instance, which got, I don't know, 45 million views. The images towards the end, whether it was the McDonald's photo op, whether it was the garbage truck, you know, he is one of his strengths is he understands image. He understands how to project certain images. And I think that was his real strength. And I think on ideas, he was you know, I mean, I think he was right about a lot of things about the economy. I think he was right that there's a problem at the border. I think he spoke to some of these specific issues that Americans have had some issues with. So I think it is definitely both. It's the weakness of the Democrats, Biden and Harris, plus Trump's ability to speak to some issues and also to kind of, you know, run a general campaign, which there were a few bumps here and there. I think the Madison Square Garden one, it doesn't look like it hurt him, but it wasn't exactly what you want to have in the final days of the campaign. But he had some, you know, he was able to send his message out in a persuasive way to enough voters, and especially enough different voters, young men, Latinos, people who are not normally, you know, not normally Republican voters. I think he brought them in.
Yeah, I'm now that we're a few days out from the election and we're sort of getting past the immediate response, some people are raising questions about what the election means for the state of the two political parties. What does it mean for the Republican Party, and what does it mean for the Democratic Party? Why don't we start first with the Republicans? Has Donald Trump completely realigned the Republican Party so that it really is now, without question and unalterably, the party of Trump?
Yes, kind of. I think the talk.
All right,
of the
that's interesting.
Yeah, the realignment stuff is, you see that everywhere now in the last few days. These are trends that have been going on, at least in my view, for decades. Right there, the working class, originally the white working class, has been moving towards the Republicans slowly, at least until since the 60s and 70s, and then down through Reagan. I mean, this has been a slow process of the migration of at first the white working class, and now it appears the Latino working class, towards the Republican Party. And then similarly, the flip side is the movement of kind of college educated suburbanites away from the Republican Party. So the Democrats have been started, I would say, in Clinton, under Clinton, and then really under Obama. And then in the last 10 years has sort of exploded. So these are trends that have been going on for a while. I think it's sort of tough to figure out whether the strength of Trump has been because of Trump himself. I mean, obviously, he had a personal appeal to a lot of working class whites, working class Latinos, especially men. You know, is that just a Trump-related phenomenon? Will that carry on to Vance and other Republicans? Or is it deeply much more issue-related? And that, I think, is unclear. But for the time being, yes, I think this is how we're going to see politics. We're going to see, you know, college-educated professionals, suburbanites, much more Democratic leaning, and working class, white and Latino, much more Republican leaning. The question is, can Trump then provide over the next few years policies that will satisfy this new coalition?
Yeah, as you, I like the word coalition, you know, it's always a good reminder that political parties really are a kind of aggregation of coalitions. And in the Republican Party, you now have this working class coalition that has become dominant with the person of Donald Trump. You've still also got, of course, religious conservatives in the coalition. You've got the kind of national defense conservatives, at least you certainly used to. And you also have kind of the business, the Chamber of Commerce folks. How are the relations going to work among these coalitions now in the Republican Party?
Well, the biggest thing you can do to keep your coalition together is to get the economy going, right? To keep a broad-based economy that provides jobs, provides, you know, increases in wages, that will keep your business part of your coalition happy, and it'll keep your working class coalition happy. So I think an economy, a strong economy, will help tamp down a lot of the conflicts within that coalition. Judges are important. Judges were important in Trump's first term. I mean, that's the kind of thing that I think also appeals to religious conservatives, to the working class, who seem to be not so much religious. I mean, but much more anti-woke. So I think you get judges, you can kind of tamp some of that down judicially. And then the other thing is foreign policy. I don't think Trump is an isolationist. I don't think that. I don't think the Republican Party is an isolationist party. But if he can kind of craft a foreign policy that is perhaps much more nationalist and have some, you know, is able to get some more victories in terms of foreign policy that will appeal to the various coalitions as well.
What about on the Democratic Party side? There has been a lot of hand-wringing. There's been a lot of recriminations. There's been a lot of blame. And the blame game always happens in electoral defeats. But this time it does seem strong, the recriminations. You have Bernie Sanders come out and say, why are we surprised that the working class abandoned us when we've abandoned the working class? You have other people saying, no, that's not the wrong, that's the wrong diagnosis. That's not been the problem. Where do things stand now in the Democratic Party?
Yeah, I mean, they've got a lot of questions to answer. This appeal to the left on cultural issues, not on economic issues, they haven't pushed it on cultural issues. They're going to have to think about that and perhaps moderating that down a little bit. And you see a little bit of that already. You see on the crime issue, you see how Democrats are kind of pulling back from the defund police stance. You see some of these left-wing prosecutors losing races. So you kind of, you're seeing some modulation of that on the Democratic side. They're going to have to figure out how, I mean, I think it's also tonal. The part of the Democratic problem is the tone, you know, the hectoring, the marginalization, the name calling, whatever side it is, that's never a great strategy. Obviously, in politics, each side calls the other. There's always name calling. But you can't marginalize tens of millions of people by calling them garbage or calling them deplorables or whatever, fascists or racists or misogynists. That's not a way forward. Probably the short-term answer for the Democrats is to wait for Trump's missteps as president and sort of pounce on those. There's nothing that will build your coalition more if you're the outside party than attacking the in-party, the mistakes of the in-party. So, you know, I don't see them coming up with any answers to the deeper structural problems of the Democratic Party in the short term. What I think they're going to end up doing is being the anti-Trump party starting in January and try to hold on to a coalition in that way. But some of their problems are really pretty deep-seated. It's tough to just be a party of the elites, right? And much more of the cultural elites, the college educated elites. It's a way of talking to people who don't have college degrees. How do you do that? So Democrats are going to have to kind of learn how to better speak to people who don't live in upscale suburban communities and have 3 graduate degrees. That's something they're going to have to learn.
Yeah, it does seem as though on that score, that when you look at the states that Trump won closely, places like Pennsylvania, you look at the percentage of people in those states who do not have a college degree, it's higher. And that's part of course, Trump's appeal and part of the difficulty for the Democratic Party. Do you foresee a revival of sort of Bernie Sanders populism? Or do you think that, as you say, there's not going to be one particular positive direction for the party? They're just going to be held together by being anti-Trump.
Well, if the Democratic Party is largely kind of driven by the interests of upper middle class suburban whites, it's hard to see Bernie Sanders getting much traction in that. It's really hard for someone living in, you know, where I live out in the suburbs of Boston, in, you know, $1 million, $2 million homes to get really excited about Bernie Sanders. Hard to see the tech folks in Silicon Valley getting really excited about giving money to a Bernie Sanders type. It won't be Bernie Sanders, he's too old, but someone like that. So I don't think, you know, the Democratic money is not with the Sanders wing. So I don't think that's going to be their future. They're going to have to figure something else out that is a little more populist, but yet still is kind of keeps attracting the donor base as well as that college-educated suburban base.
The broader movement, and you, because you in a way raised the question of, you know, the future of Trump. He's a one-term president. Seems like he picked J.D. Vance as vice president because he wanted to continue the movement, right? Rather than for electoral politics. He obviously didn't need Ohio or the demographic that J.D. speaks to. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the broader electorate and what kinds of things you've seen maybe from 2016 on, maybe earlier than that. Is the electorate itself changing, shifting, realigning in such a way that we're going to see that continue in the future? Or is this just a moment in time?
No, I think these are trends that have been going on for some time, and I think will continue to go. Vance is set up to kind of continue this this so-called realignment, this working class realignment among Republicans. I also think that in some ways, if Vance plays it right, he could appeal also to the suburban voters as well, which used to be part of the Republican coalition. He's young. He's got an Ivy League degree. He's a military vet. There's a lot there that is appealing, I think, to not just the white working class. So in that sense, in my view, if the Republicans are going to move forward, they're going to have to take this new coalition, whatever you would call it, and try to peel off some more of that suburban vote that they've been losing over the last few years. I think a lot of the suburban vote over the last few years obviously has been anti-Trump. I mean, I know in my own world, plenty of conservative, moderate conservative types who just haven't voted for Trump, won't vote for Trump. But they would vote, I think, for a Vance or a DeSantis or someone else like that. I think there's still room there to move. But I think it's still, we're still a not quite a 50-50 country, but we're still a pretty tightly divided nation. And I don't think that's going to change anytime soon. I think the best way to break out of that is for our president to succeed. And we've had some failed presidential administrations over the last 10, 20 years who've not really been successful. And if, I mean, starting, I would say, I mean, it depends how far back you want to go, but certainly the way to build your coalition and keep it together is to be successful, is to get legislative wins, to have strong economies that draw more people to your party. And we haven't seen that with both Democratic and Republican presidents. So the next president, whether it's Trump, whether it's Vance, whether it's the, if a Democrat wins in 2028, the next president that can do that, that can actually show some successes, that can make government work a little bit better, that can improve our standing in the world, that can strengthen the economy, I think we'll be able to help break out of that 50-50 split.
And some commentators have noted that this election is, while it's sort of has the recurring theme of Donald Trump and Joe Biden, or at least did, was really historically anomalous because obviously you haven't had a presidential situation like Donald Trump since Grover Cleveland, right? Where winning. And then on the other side, the odd situation of having a presidential candidate, the incumbent president, dropping out with only a few months left to go and putting his sitting vice president in a very difficult situation. How much at play were these unusual, historically anomalous forces?
Yeah, I mean, they were huge. As a historian, people always want to ask me, you know, give us the historical precedent for this. And yes, there is the Grover Cleveland one, but honestly, for all the reasons you mentioned, I mean, this has been pretty unprecedented. You know, you have you've got a candidate who has been convicted of a crime and is waiting sentencing. And on the other side, you have a president who in his 80s, who clearly is suffering from some kind of mental condition, right? He's definitely aging and not up to being president, and then has a disastrous debate and then drops out a couple of months before the race. I mean, this is unprecedented territory. So, and I think that's one of the reasons why the election was so unsettling to many people is these are, you know, and we coming out of a pandemic a few years ago, major pandemic, which really wreaked havoc on our country and in the world. Not just the number of deaths, but, you know, we see it in the education system of young kids, and we're going to see this for a long, long time to come. And I think we're still grappling with some of the after effects of the pandemic. So all of these things have made for a really unprecedented time in America. And that makes things, I think, that heightens the tensions that surround our politics.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to have one of our faculty members tell you about a special documents-based graduate program for teachers of American history, government, and civics.
Hi. Hi, this is John Moser, chair of the Master of Arts in American History and Government program at Ashland University. If you are an educator who teaches U.S. history, government, or politics, our program may be just what you've been looking for. Our approach is to emphasize primary sources, since we think the best way to study the past is to read the words of those who lived it. We have a distinguished faculty made up of professors from both Ashland University and from colleges and universities across the country. And they're not there to lecture to you. We think it's better to learn through conversation about the documents. Ours is a hybrid program with two different types of seminar. The first are our week-long intensive in-person courses during the summers on the beautiful campus of Ashland University. The second are our live synchronous online seminars offered throughout the year. So if you're a social studies teacher and you're looking to deepen your understanding of America's past and its politics, please check out the Master of Arts in American History and Government program. You can do that by visiting tah.org/programs.
What about if we move from the presidential election to the other national elections, of course, the Senate, the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House? It looks as though Republicans have now, of course, established themselves as the majority in the U.S. Senate, which will be incredibly helpful to President Trump in his, you know, appointments and nominations. Again, what did you see in the Senate race that you think that really struck you as noteworthy?
Yeah, I think, you know, the same states that were the battleground states saw really, really tight races for the Senate. And the fact that all of them were, you know, the Michigan, Wisconsin, Nevada, Pennsylvania, all decided by basically a percentage point either way, tells you about how divided the country is. It's an aspect of that. It's an aspect of, the Republicans have managed to have some congressional strength through these years, even with the difficulties that Trump has had. I think if you look at McCormick, it's interesting. The candidates that were running in these battleground states were not exactly MAGA candidates. You know, McCormick, the guy in a lot of vets, like the guy in Wisconsin, the guy in Nevada. Yeah. These are, Moreno in your state is a little more of a MAGA type candidate, I would say, than the others. But what you've seen in the congressional races over the last 8 years or so is the MAGA candidates, full-throated MAGA candidates, tend not to do so well. Perry Lake, I think Arizona was probably a winnable race this year for Republicans, given how well Trump did. But, you know, Lake was just not the right candidate. I think she didn't run well last time and probably shouldn't have run this time either. You're going to have to find candidates who can straddle the line, appealing to this new working class Republicanism, but without some of the, some of the MAGAism, right? Some of the things that turns off some voters, that whether it's Kerry Lake or some of the other candidates that over the last few years, that Republican candidates who have not done well in the congressional races.
And on the House side, it looks like the Republicans are going to keep probably a narrow majority, 220, 221, 222. Seats. That means that if it's Speaker Johnson, that they're going to have incredibly narrow again majority. That means that putting legislation together, as we know, is going to be incredibly difficult. It's going to be really messy, a lot of sausage making, as they say. Tell us a little bit about your understanding of the situation of the House. And again, were you surprised by the fact that the Republicans appear to have maintained the majority?
I was a little surprised about the House. That was not something that had been predicted. I think the reason, if the Republicans do take it, it's because of the strength of Trump in those blue states, specifically California and New York. Now, he didn't win those states, but he did well enough and drew enough voters that he was able to bring up some of those congressional candidates in New York and California and push them over the edge. I mean, I think California, when all is said and done, if Republicans pick up those seats, that will probably put them, you know, the margins. And then a couple of Republicans lost a couple of seats in New York that they had won earlier, but they were able to keep a number of votes in the state. And I think that's a testament to that Trump ran better in some of these blue states than he had before. To me, that one of the most important things about the Republicans keeping the House is there won't be an impeachment. You know, I think had Democrats taken over, there would have been a strong incentive for them to run out impeachment pretty quickly against Trump on whatever, you know, whatever he did, they would find an excuse, I think, to do impeachment proceedings. So we won't have that, which I think is good in general for the country not to go through that. Obviously, I think Johnson's going to have a hard time. I think some of the problems that he had in the previous session, he's going to have now. You've got that when you have a few of the kind of more conservative MAGA type Freedom Caucus, whatever you want to call them, who have been putting pressure on first McCarthy and now Johnson. I think that's going to continue. I don't think that Johnson, it'll be hard to say how many of the new Republicans coming to Congress, are they going to line up with the leadership, or are they going to line up with the Freedom Caucus, with the MAGA folks? That's not entirely clear. You know, probably have a little bit of wiggle room at the beginning. There'll be certainly be some good feelings, but yeah, the Republicans have to be very careful about not going down that road that they went through last time of cannibalizing themselves and attacking their own. They've got a narrow majority, and they have to find ways to coalesce and to try to do something.
And what do you think the task will be for Hakeem Jeffries?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's probably one of the most disappointed people after Harris. After this, I think he was probably expecting to be Speaker of the House. I think most of Nancy Pelosi and the others thought that they were going to take the House. He's got an easier job in the sense that I think his caucus is going to be united behind him. The Democrats are pretty united in that sense. I mean, you have the progressive wing, although the squad has taken some hits in the last couple of years. But in general, I think there's a little more unity on the Democratic side, and they're united against Donald Trump. I think that's pretty easy for the Democratic side. So I think they're going to pick their battles. I think they're going to attack Trump when they can. And then Jeffries is going to try to figure out ways to divide the Republicans. How can he, I don't think Republicans are never going to peel off and vote for him, but can he do some mischief on the Republican side that might help to peel some people off from Johnson and stymie whatever the Republicans are doing?
And if we drop from the federal level, I mean, this is really fascinating stuff, but if we get on from the federal level, of course, to the state level, which in our federal system continues to be important. We saw governor's races. It looks like it's going to be 27 Republican and 23 Democrats, if I'm not mistaken. No real changes. I'm wondering if that itself is surprising. So just for example, it's always surprising. I had a friend who turned to me and said, did you know that Vermont has a Republican governor? How can they have a Republican governor when Bernie Sanders is their senator? And I said, this is an interesting fact about American politics at the state level. It's not always as predictable.
Yeah, we in New England here, you also have New Hampshire, where Kelly Ayotte, the Republican, won the race for Republican, and she's taking over for Chris Sununu, who is a Republican, even though New Hampshire has gone Democratic on the federal level for the last few cycles. A long time in Massachusetts, we've had Republican governors like Mitt Romney, like Charlie Baker. So there's this tendency up in New England here to, at the local level, to look at more moderate Republicans and to trust them with running the state. But they're generally more moderate Republicans, and they have to, you know, Chris Sununu has been kind of a critic of Trump. Certainly the governor of Vermont is very much an anti-Trumper, and he has to be politically if he wants to continue. So we've definitely seen that. For Republicans, in the gubernatorial race, obviously the North Carolina one was the toughest one. It's a race that probably should have won, but again, they had a MAGA type candidate who had some serious issues and was just not going to win. So I think that was an issue. I mean, the Republicans have, over the last 10, 20 years, maybe even more, have been really strong at the state level and have had a number of strong governors. They've been able to show, I think that's helped the Republican Party overall, because they've been able to show that they have governors who are able to govern. And that's been a problem in Washington, right? The ability that Republicans have always had a problem, like since the 80s, of governing. When you're the anti-government party, when you're the outsider, when you run against Washington, once you become the governing party, it's been tough for Republicans, with some exceptions here and there. It's been tough to govern. But at the state level, whether it's DeSantis in Florida, whether it's, you know, DeWine in Ohio, there's a number of governors who have actually, you know, shown that they can govern in a moderately conservative way that appeals to voters.
In this age of what a lot of analysts say, the nationalization of all elections, I wonder, though, if you're talking, for example, about those New England governors, and there still seems to be some willingness of people to split tickets, how much, though, does candidate quality matter in an age of nationalized elections?
Yeah, I mean, North Carolina is a big example there. It's an extreme example, but I still think there are issues of candidate. You want to have solid candidates. Mitch McConnell, for whatever criticisms, I know he comes into a lot of criticisms from some conservatives, but I mean, he's done generally a pretty good job over the years of recruiting good senatorial candidates that are able to appeal to a broader swath of the population rather than maybe the narrower, more conservative views. So, you know, whether it's North Carolina, whether it's Kerry Lake in Arizona. Yeah, I think had you had different Republicans in those states, I think you would have had different outcomes. So it's important. Here in New England, you can't, you know, Charlie Baker ran and was governor for two terms as a kind of moderate Republican. And that was successful for him. You're not going to run for statewide office in Massachusetts and win as anything more conservative than that. It's just not going to happen. Same thing in New Hampshire. I think abortion was an issue, especially in New England. Kelly Ayotte had to kind of deal with that issue. That's an issue for us. I think that's one of the more difficult issues for Republicans, not just in New England, but I think now even in other parts of the country, it's become a tricky issue for Republicans.
And in the Democratic Party now, who do you see as emerging personalities, emerging stars? You say Bernie Sanders is probably too old to affect him in his person, not his ideology, but in his person. Then, of course, there are people like Hakeem Jeffries, other people who will be during the Trump presidency of the next 4 years, Democrats to watch around the country.
Look to governors, right? That's been a Republican thing for a while, right? Look to governors, look to those who are able to govern and get reelected.
Does that mean Gavin Newsom, for example?
Yeah, I think Gavin Newsom, he's the biggest state in the union, most electoral votes, lots of money in California. I think, and he's got ambition. I think he wants it. Gretchen Whitmer, apparently, you know, lots of Democrats like her up in Michigan. I'm fond of her. I think Josh Shapiro, in some ways, I think he comes out better after this election because I do think Harris would have been better off picking him. So he's an appealing Democratic candidate. Those are three governors sort of right off the bat that I think Democrats would want to look at. And they're also they're Democrats who have some of the flaws, especially Newsom, that have gotten Democrats in trouble. I don't think Newsom has been very good at talking to working class voters. It's very much a kind of an elite-driven agenda that he's had over in California. Whitmer's obviously a little bit different. She's been able to get elected in Michigan. But yeah, they're going to have to, I think they're going to look to the governors to find someone who can kind of, I don't say rebuild the Democratic Party, but maybe refocus the party, refocus their message.
And their relationship with organized labor. I mean, we saw Teamsters president, for example, speaking at the Republican convention, blasting leaders of the Democratic Party and saying that they take us for granted in ways that they never should have. What about the role of organized labor over the next term?
Yeah, organized labor is a kind of a tricky topic because there is no such thing as organized labor, right? There's lots of different unions out there. The UAW is very different from SEIU. So SEIU is much more lockstep with the Democratic Party. The UAW, some of the more blue collar ones like in the construction trades, the Teamsters, they're the ones that Democrats are having more issues with, as opposed to some of the more, I don't know, pink collar unions that you might have, like SEIU, like the teachers union, right? That's another, probably one of the strongest unions in the country, is still firmly democratic. So very different from some of the more blue collar unions. So I think, you know, I think some of the green agenda has made things difficult for Democrats in terms of more blue collar union voters. I think they're going to have to try to figure some of that out and try to figure out, you know, I think Trump's energy policy, I think that might help with blue collar voters. Whether it's the teachers union or SEIU, these are still going to be strong Democratic, strong parts of the Democratic coalition. They're going to be there. So, yeah, I often say it's hard to say there is such a thing as organized labor or unions, because there are very different unions out there that represent very different constituencies. And we saw that in this last election. You know, I think in some ways there's also a divide in organized labor in some of these unions between the rank and file and the leadership. Whereas what you saw in the last election was that it's the rank and file who said, no, we're not going with the Democrats. You know, we want Trump. And the leadership had to sort of step back. And in most of these cases, they became neutral, right? And they did that because their rank and file was not going along with it, would not go along with the Democrats.
Since before Harry Truman, every president, maybe we go all the way back to Thomas Jefferson and telling people not to read newspapers. Every president has a vexed relationship with the media. Every president complains that they get bad media coverage and that the media only covers the problems with their administration. What do you foresee as the media relationship and media presence in this Trump term?
It would be terrible. Adversarial.
Now tell us what you really think.
Adversarial, yes. Clearly, I think that the media is going to take it upon themselves to be the check and balance against the Trump administration. And that's what they did in the first term. That's what they'll do now. You know, I don't think the media did very well for itself over the last 4 years. I don't think I ought to say take a small issue with you. I don't think Kamala Harris can come out and say that the media was tough on her over the last 3 months. You know, I think she got very positive, probably overly positive attention. It didn't help her, obviously. That's another thing that I think especially Republicans need to learn. If the press is against you, it doesn't mean you're going to lose. Like, the press doesn't have as much power sometimes as we think it does. But yeah, mm-hmm. I think the press relations with Trump is going to be very adversarial. They're going to view themselves, rightly or wrongly, as almost a separate branch of government keeping a check on the White House. And I think Trump himself is going to take a very adversarial role with the press. He's shown it before. Vance has shown it during the campaign. He was very tough in his interviews with and pushed back very hard against the press. So I think you're going to see a lot more of that.
Maybe this is an unfair question to end with, but what do you get for our listeners? Looking back, as you have you're historically minded, and you've had a chance to sort of think through some of these things from previous administrations and eras in American history. What's one thing that we should be looking for that we might not be looking for right now for the next 4 years that you think is going to be important for understanding this period in American history?
Yeah, the obvious answer, which I think people are looking at, is going to be the economy. What everyone looks at. But I would actually say that people should be looking at foreign policy and foreign affairs, that the world is very unsettled these days. There's a lot that's going on, whether it's the Middle East, whether it's China. Foreign policy didn't get a whole lot of attention in the campaign, I don't think. And I think that we should be looking at what happens on the world stage in the next few years. What happens with our relationship with China? What does Trump do in terms of the Middle East? I mean, I think he's obviously going to cut off Iran, and I think that's going to have an impact on the Middle East. He's has a better relationship with Israel. What's going to happen? What will Trump do with the Russia-Ukraine war? Will there be a truce there, a negotiated truce? But I think this is a pretty unsettling time worldwide. So I would be looking at foreign affairs and what the Trump administration can do to kind of settle things down while at the same time strengthening America in terms of our military, in terms of our Navy, in terms of whatever challenges we're, I think we're going to be facing in the coming years.
Fascinating. Wow. This has been an amazing, wide-ranging, deeply insightful, wonderful conversation. Professor Vincent Cannato, wow, thank you for taking the time to join us today on The American Idea. And let me remind our listeners of Vince's great books, his American Passage, The History of Ellis Island. Highly want to recommend that. And we're looking forward to your new book coming out shortly.
Great. Thanks, Jeff. I really enjoyed it. Great talking to you.
Thanks again for joining us on The American Idea.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.